This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, welcome to this Moneybox podcast. New rules are planned to stop people losing track of their growing number of small pensions. What's the best way to pay for things if you're going on holiday abroad? And there are calls for bereavement benefits to be increased with inflation and last longer than a year and a half. But first, nearly 10,000 people have needed free debt advice in the last 12 months because of mistakes by the Department for Work and Pensions. They've been overpaid because of what is known as official error, but the department normally demands they pay back the money it wrongly gave them in the first place. Those figures have been given exclusively to Moneybox by Money Wellness, a debt advice provider funded by the government's own Money and Pension Service. Money Wellness says most of its clients are households on low incomes, so paying back the money they thought was theirs can devastate the rest of their finances. That happened to Kevin Hilton, who was told he owed more than £13,000 after being paid Universal Credit, which he was then told he shouldn't have had. But following an investigation by Moneybox, the Department for Work and Pensions admitted that was a mistake. Our reporter Dan Whitworth went to talk to him.
On the edge of an enormous construction site in the middle of the Warwickshire countryside, with trucks constantly rumbling in and out, is where I meet Kevin.
My name is Kevin Hilton. I'm 46 years old. I live in Erdington, Birmingham.
For the past 18 months, he's been working here as a crane supervisor.
Yeah, whoop, I'll be with you shortly, OK?
Whilst at the same time making increasingly desperate attempts to try to get help and answers from the Department for Work and Pensions about universal credit payments he received during COVID when a severe bout of depression left him unable to work.
So the DWP, they said that they overpay me to the tune of £13,000 and some hundred pounds, which, in all honesty, they haven't overpaid me, and they've just been hounding me for that money for the last 2 or 3 years, you see. One of the impacts of that as well, they stopped my benefit. They stopped my benefit, you know?
So it was like a double whammy. Not only were you told you had all this debt that you had to repay, but they stopped your benefit as well.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
As well as missing out on his universal credit payments, Kevin also lost out on help with his rent and council tax too, meaning he fell into even more debt.
There was no lecky inside the house. There was no lecky because I just didn't have any money. And there was a time when I was going to the food bank just to get food inside the house, you see.
Following an investigation by Moneybox, within days, Kevin learned that £13,000 debt had been cancelled. The DWP told us after evidence provided by Mr. Hilton, it cancelled his overpayment and apologised for any distress caused.
So up until I spoke into Moneybox, there were no movement from the DWP. They were adamant that this is an overpayment. The best word I can choose from my vocabulary, it's like you're speaking to robots. There is no human touch. There is no taking into consideration a person's personal circumstances. It's really sad because I've always worked since I've arrived in this country. I came here in 1999 and I've been working since, and I've been always contributing my tax and my national insurance without quibble or qualms. And it's kind of shocking to know that the one time when I needed something from the system that I've been contributing to, this is the way I was dealt with. And it's not only myself which is in this situation. There are thousands and thousands of other people in this same predicament.
Well, with me in our Salford studio is Sabrina McCulloch, Director of External Affairs at Money Wellness. Sabrina McCulloch, Kevin, in fact, hadn't been overpaid, had he? He was entitled to the money he'd been given. The mistake was the DWP demanding it back. Does that happen often?
That's right, Paul. Exactly that. So we speak to about 10,000 people last year that have been overpaid. And typically when they go through the mandatory reconsideration process, we see that 1 in 20 of those people then end up with a reverse decision or that the calculation was incorrect.
Yeah, and mandatory reconsideration is what most of us call appeals, isn't it? That's the official word for what you have to do. But of course, many people are paid too much because of mistakes. mistakes by officials, and altogether I know you had nearly 10,000 cases in just 12 months. Are they always forced to repay the money if they didn't, if they weren't entitled to it and officials gave it them wrongly?
Yeah, so almost 80% of overpayments actually are recovered from benefit deductions. So we always encourage people to go through the mandatory appeal process just to ensure that the overpayment is actually calculated correctly.
Yeah, so they have to pay it back. These are people by definition on limited incomes. How does that affect them having to pay this money back?
Yeah, absolutely. So typically where a benefit deduction is taken from the current claim, it is a significant proportion of people's incomes, so or their income top up for that current year, leads to issues we see with things like paying childcare, so therefore not able to continue to go to work, or heating the homes and purchasing essentials like food, which is what we've just heard from Kevin.
And what sort of amounts do they have to overpay? What's typical?
So the average amount is about £2,000 that we see from customers that we support, but that can vary from a few £100s to a few £1,000s.
Yes, that's a lot of money, and that comes off their monthly benefit, their universal credit. How much would that be?
It does, yes. So the average that we see for a deduction is about £64, which can be a significant chunk of the money that they're receiving.
Yes, and you mentioned people in work, and of course, Kevin was working. Are most of the people on Universal Credit come to you working as well as claiming benefits?
Absolutely. So around 40% of Universal Credit claimants are working. That includes NHS workers, teachers, so lots of people that are in work, and with many others with reasons that they're unable to work.
Now, we all know how complicated the benefit system is. Why are these errors made, though, by the people who are actually using it every day? Is it a lack of training or is it just that complexity?
I think our view would be that the benefit system is so complex and difficult to navigate that perhaps the people that are working in the background doing those calculations are also struggling. So for us, simplifying that system, providing support where errors are made and making sure that the deductions are affordable for people that have to pay them back is paramount.
And are people told why they have been overpaid, or do they have to work that out?
No, so the letters typically that they receive will tell them that there is an overpayment but doesn't provide any information on the calculation, which then requires people to contact the benefits agency to understand how that has happened, and then they have a month if they want to go through the mandatory appeals process.
And briefly, in a word or two, what do you want to see happen?
I think it would be great if we could simplify the benefits system, but in the short term, adding information to people's Universal Credit Journal, such as the overpayment amount and why it was calculated, could prevent a lot of calls to DWP and make sure that claimants are able to assess whether they should mandatory appeal process.
Sabrina McCulloch of Bunny Milner, thanks. And I should add, DWP, the Department for Work and Pensions, says its staff work hard to support customers, and it is important to explore ways to reduce fraud and error so it can support the most vulnerable in society, and it has a huge budget. Billions are given out, and the official error rate is half of 1%. Now, the government's planning a revolution in the way pension funds are administered and invested. One of the key changes that will affect everyone in work will mean that small amounts of several different pensions that people have paid into as they go from job to job would all be in one place instead of having sort of one pot for each employer as happens now. And that's important because the Pensions Policy Institute estimated there was more than £26 billion of lost pension money in the system, and it needed to be reunited with nearly 3 million people who owned it. And those numbers have grown hugely in just 4 years. Our reporter Sarah Rogers spoke to people at Sale Water Park in Greater Manchester about their pension pots.
Probably like four, five, I think, maybe. Any idea what's... You don't have to... Don't tell me the number, but any idea what's in them or...?
No, not a chance. It's kind of a struggle to keep track of everything.
I don't have a clue. I just know I'm paying into it. From college, I went straight into my current employer, and I've been there for like 10 years, so I've been on that. But then after 5 years, they give you an option to go into like a different pension. So I think I've got two pensions, but I really honestly don't know. I just hope for the best of me.
Do you know how many pension pots you've paid into and where they all are?
Yes, I'm an ex-policeman, so that's
easy for you.
Yeah, I'm also ex-police, but I've also had a few other jobs. And if you were to ask where the pensions were, I'd have to actually go looking, because I've had a few driving jobs as well. So I've paid into pensions at these places, and I've not really done anything about them since.
So do you even know where they are, who they're with?
No.
Yeah, it can get tricky. Remembering what's where.
Yeah. How do you keep track of yours?
Husband.
I just get statements through the post.
Yeah, it's something that I tend to pop to the back of my mind because it's not something that I'm looking forward to.
Listening to that is Helen Morrissey, Head of Retirement Analysis at Hargreaves Lansdown. Helen Morrissey, the theme at that park was, yeah, I've got some pension pots, I don't really know where they are or what they're worth. How's the government planning to change that?
Absolutely, it's a huge issue. I think basically detail is scant right now, but what it's kind of looking like is that if you have what they call a deferred pot, you know, once you kind of, you know, left your job or you've not paid into it for a while, the idea is that these pots will be brought together in one place into like a consolidator. So the idea being that if you had three or four old pots, they would all be brought together in one, just to make it easier for people to keep track of the pensions that they've had.
And I suppose it's how it works, isn't it? Because we've had more schemes to do that before, haven't we? The idea of having a pension pot follow you around, it was called. The Conservatives have their pot for life, and similar ideas have been floated. But how will this actually work, and how different will it be?
I do think certainly something needs to happen to try and, you know, help people keep track of these pots. And I think, you know, if they're brought together under a certain like number of consolidators, like, you know, certain providers stepping forward to do this, then it will make things easier. But then, as you say, Paul, there are other things that could be done. You mentioned there the pot for life. You know, they've got the lifetime pension there, which could work in terms of getting people to stipulate which provider they want their pension contributions paid into, with the meaning being that they would keep that pension theoretically throughout their whole career, which would make it much easier for them to keep track of. You know, that's another issue that government could look at.
Yes, I, from what you're saying, I sort of sense a review coming up, which of course could delay things, couldn't it? How long might this take? I mean, we had the pensions dashboard. Now, that was meant to put pensions information in one place. It was first announced in 2016. It's still not happening. It wasn't even mentioned by the government this time. How long will this take?
As I say, nothing would be likely to happen soon, I must admit. You know, they'd need to build the infrastructure around that. You know, how would these consolidators work? How would the pension funds be allocated? You know, it certainly isn't something that would be done overnight. And as you say, you know, we are seeing progress on the dashboard, but we're still a couple of years away from seeing it implemented.
Yes, I mean, we have to say dashboards, don't we? Because different firms can all run one. But one thing that would boost most people's pensions is to raise those contribution levels for auto-enrolled pensions and start people paying in younger and on lower incomes. Now, the previous government said it would do those three things. Is there any prospect of those being introduced soon?
I really hope so. As you say, that bill, in order to do that got Royal Assent, you know, almost a year ago. And I think it's really, really important that they do announce some kind of timetable. You know, they might maybe look to do it in the budget, for instance, because it is something that could significantly help people to build bigger pots.
Yes, because it would cost them money, and that's the other issue, unless employers chipped in more. But anyway, we'll have to see what happens there. And just briefly, back to these lost pots. If people like those people in the water park in Sale think they've got a pension, don't know where it is, briefly, how do they find it?
OK, the best way of doing it is to call the Government Pension Tracing Service. All you need to give them would be the name of your employer or the name of the pension provider. Now, the service can't tell you if you've got a pension with them, but they can give you the contact details so you can contact them and find out.
Right, so that's on, I think, gov.uk, and then search pension tracing. But don't Google it, just go straight to gov.uk and do that.
Absolutely.
Helen Morrissey, thanks very much for talking to us from Hargreaves Lansdown. Well, the summer holidays are starting, and if you're going abroad, there's any number of ways to waste money. Not on nice things, but giving too much to your bank or credit card provider, or indeed to foreign banks where you go. So how should you pay while you're away? Moneybox's Catherine Lund has the details. Catherine.
Well, travellers' checks have gone. Cash is less and less welcome. Plastic cards and your mobile phone are easy and quick. But that is where you can be stung. Almost all debit and credit cards come with an extra charge. if you used to pay them in a foreign currency. It's called a foreign transaction fee, and it adds a shade under 3% to everything you spend. Some debit and credit cards don't charge that, so do check if yours does before you use it.
Yes, or I suppose if there's time, take a new one out or a new account before you go away where there has one of those cards. But what if there isn't that time? What can you do quickly?
The alternative, which is quick and easy to get, is a prepaid currency card to add money to before you go away, if you can afford to do that. They don't charge foreign transaction fees, but like all prepaid cards, they may come with some other charges if you're not careful.
Now, if you're in a hotel or a shop or even at an ATM abroad, you might get asked how you want to pay, in euros if you're in Europe, or in sterling. Which should you choose? Here's travel expert Rob Staines.
Always pay in local currency. Quite often that we sit down at a restaurant, we're paying for the bill, and the server will ask us, would you like to pay in, say, euros or sterling? Always pay in the currency of the country that you're in, because otherwise you're going to get really unfavourable exchange rates. And it's also the merchant and the bank that's actually going to benefit from that, but not us.
Rob Staines with very clear advice there. And Catherine, you mentioned choosing the cards, the sort of cards, without mentioning any brands. Where can people find out more?
Just search cards to use abroad on websites like moneysavingexpert.com or which.co.uk, which have excellent information about all of this.
And brands?
With brands.
Thanks very much, Catherine. And there's also a really useful MoneyBots Live on your travel rights, which you can find on BBC Sounds. Campaigners are calling for benefits given to parents with dependent children whose partner has died to be paid for longer and to rise with inflation. Since 2017, a parent under pension age whose partner dies is entitled to what's called bereavement support payment. If they have children, that's normally £3,500 up front and monthly payments of £350 for at most 18 months. Now, those bereavement support payments were introduced in April 2017. They replaced a different system which parents could use to be given financial support until their youngest child reached 18. Sophie is 26. When she was 25 and 17 weeks pregnant, her husband Paul died in a road accident. She's been getting bereavement support payment, but, as she told our reporter Joe Krasner, it'll run out soon when her daughter Poppy is just 1 year old.
I rely on that money so much, and my financial situation won't have changed at all in those 18 months. I'm currently on maternity leave and due to go back to work, but not sure how that's going to work because of the cost of childcare on my own is just extortionate.
So what would you like to see happen?
I think it's really important to see the length of time that you receive the payments for extended. Previously, there was payments until your child was 18, and in 2017 that was reduced to 18 months.
What do you think is a fairer figure?
I think it should go back to 18. My financial situation won't have changed after 18 months. I still will have the additional expenses of being a single parent. I have to pay for a handyman to come and do things that my husband would have done before. I'm also paying for trauma-specific bereavement counselling, which is expensive, and those kinds of things I'm not sure how I'll be able to do after that time.
And what about the actual payment you receive?
I don't think it at all matches the loss that I have each month from a financial perspective. I've lost thousands of pounds each month. I'm having to pay for extra things. Babies are expensive. I'm having to pay for childcare help, having to buy nappies, milk, wipes all on my own. Luckily, I have family who help, and my mum has been able to reduce how much she works to be able to help me out with childcare. So I'm lucky in that sense, but £350 for 18 months is not enough.
Sophie, talking to our reporter Joe Krasner. The Department for Work and Pensions told us that it knows losing a loved one is devastating and that it is committed to supporting those most in need through the welfare system. Well, listening to all that is Vicky Anning. She's from the charity Way, Widowed and Young. Vicky Anning, Sophie's story is just so sad. And just remind us what people in her position get.
So, yes, it's absolutely heartbreaking to hear stories of bereaved parents like Sophie, who's worried about her financial future while, you know, she's still reeling from the emotional and practical impacts of her bereavement. So what parents in her situation are entitled to is the bereavement support payment, which you mentioned in your intro. That includes a lump sum payment of £3,500 and then 18 monthly payments of £350.
And why only 18 monthly payments? Because that's just a year and a half, and as you she said, you know, Poppy will only be 1 year old when they stop. She's still going to need help, isn't she?
Well, that's right. So, I mean, what's even more heartbreaking is that if Sophie had been widowed before the 6th of April 2017, she would potentially have received support for Poppy until Poppy went to, you know, until she left school. So the system was changed in April 2017. It was cut from that longer period of 18 years to just the 18 months.
Yes, and widowed parents' allowance was a lot more, wasn't it, than the bereavement payments.
That's that, right, yeah.
That Sophie gets. She also talked about that, didn't she? £350 a month, not enough, as you said. She wants it to rise with inflation. I believe that's your policy too. Roughly, do you know what it would be if it had risen with other benefits?
So by our calculations, it's short by about £100 a month. So the goods and services like nappies, childcare, etc., would cost an extra £100 a month in today's money compared to 2017.
Yes, so that would be a great help if it was raised, though, as I said, it's still less than widowed parents' allowance was.
Yes.
And you've written to the new Work and Pension Secretary, Liz Kendall, about this. The current bereavement support system was brought in, as you've been saying, in 2017. It replaced the previous one, and support there lasted years, not months. Are you in a way just trying to undo that change and go back to 2017?
So the change was introduced under Theresa May's government, and it was basically shortened in order to save money. And we would like to see long-term bereavement support restored. So we would like to see it go beyond the 18 months, obviously, for as long as possible, for more than 6 years. So we've been working with a coalition of charities under the Commission, UK Commission on Bereavement, who have also called for payments to be extended beyond 6 years and uprated in line with inflation. So we are hoping that we will get some support from the new government.
Yes, because it's a very rare benefit that doesn't go up with inflation, isn't it? Now, the Department for Work and Pensions told us these payments aren't intended to meet day-to-day living costs and that families in need should consider applying for universal credit, for example. People might think that is the right way to support those who need it without giving money to those who don't.
So our belief is that the payments are based on the national insurance contributions of the late partner. So we very much believe that those payments are based on the entitlement of a pension that your late partner may never have got to draw down, sadly. So we feel that this money should be earmarked towards supporting bereaved families who are, you know, at really the most devastating time in their lives. Like Sophie, she hasn't been able to, to get back on her feet, and she's now expected to go back to work.
Which she said were very difficult, didn't she, losing
a child
that
involves.
Said it would be very difficult losing that money. Now, we know the new Labour government's got a lot in its in tray, and we'll hear on Monday just how big that hole in public finances is. How could they pay for it?
So we know that there's been some savings made in the retrospective payments claims that were made when payments were extended to cohabiting couples. We know those savings of around £160 million, and we hope that money could be earmarked towards helping bereaved families. And in the long term, we believe that, you know, the welfare system should be set up to support families in dire need like Sophie's.
Vicky,
in the longer term.
A lot of people are hoping a lot from the Labour government, aren't they? Vicky Anning from Widowed and Young, thanks. Now, we talked about holiday cash earlier, and the Moneybox podcast is now off on its holidays. Time to catch up on all those you missed on BBC Sounds. Moneybox Live is also on BBC Sounds, of course, and in its final outing before the summer, Felicity Hannah will be looking at the cost of being creative, speaking to people who hope to build successful creative careers, but how to pay the bills while pursuing that dream job. Artist, writer, actor, singer. Broadcaster even. Email the programme with questions or experiences, moneybox@bbc.co.uk. In holiday mode, in this podcast, we're reporters Dan Whitworth, Catherine Lund, Sarah Rogers and Joe Krasner, researcher Emmy Rhodes, studio manager Lindsay Akehurst. Our editor is Jess Quayle. I'm Paul Lewis, and this was a BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds. And now, a more serious breakout.
I'm Carlo Gabler from BBC Radio 4, and the history podcast, this is Escape from the Maze, the disturbing inside story of the biggest jailbreak in British and Irish history.
It's a major aberration. It's no different from an IRA aberration, I'd say.
Told by the people who carried it out and the people who tried to stop them.
The staff were terrorised, obviously having difficulty breathing.
It's an escape planned in forensic detail.
It's a need-to-know basis, and if you don't need to know, you don't know.
That creates shockwaves at the heart of government.
It is a very grave incident indeed, the most serious in our prison history.
Find Escape from the Maze on the History Podcast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.